Thanks for tuning in to Women's Voices. My name is Genevieve Gluck, and in this episode, I speak with Renee Gerlich, a feminist writer and artist based in New Zealand. Her writing can be found at Feminist Current, Savage Minds, and her blog, reneejg.net. In 2021, she founded Dragon Cloud Press to publish her brief Complete Her Story, a female-centered history of the world from the Big Bang to present-day neoliberalism. Her book, Out of the Fog, on politics, feminism, and coming alive, which explores the deep roots of the contradictions that characterize today's political landscape, will be published by Spinifex Press later this year. Hey, Renee, it's really nice to talk with you. We've been friends on social media for some time and involved in a radical feminist book club on Facebook that we were taking part in. And I've been a fan of your blog and your writings for a few years now, especially some of the bigger picture thinking that you do in terms of tracing the history of patriarchy and things like this, which is actually why we're talking today. So yeah, could you go ahead and introduce your work and your life and your activism?
Sure. So I'm based in New Zealand, and I am probably about as grassroots as they come in terms of feminism and activism. Don't have any institutional organizational affiliations. So my work is based on the questions that I have and the questions that, current events make me ask, and I read in order to address questions. So I'm quite a methodical reader. And my work is based around conveying what has taken me quite some time to read. So I often write with the hopes that I will, save women time reading multiple times when I know a lot of women don't have the time to do tons and tons of reading. So I really like to synthesize. And that's probably one of my number one impulses when it comes to questioning and researching and writing, is to, ask big or deep questions and then go looking quite broadly and then synthesize material. So I often have sort of broad, deep takes on what's going on, but I'm often much less informed about, daily events. So that's my work, and it's very obscure. I have basically no voice in my own country. I've been banned from everything, even, the gender critical stuff that's going on here. So
that's a shame.
Yeah, so from the beginning, so as soon as I started writing my feminist blogs, I used to be involved in the political left in New Zealand. And then as soon as I started writing a feminist blog, I just started getting, as feminists do, as you know, like banned from various events, including the Wellington Zine Fest, which it's just a fair where people can go along and share like little handmade booklets. So it's kind of, I like those kinds of events, because to me they're kind of, if we have anything like true democracy, it's probably represented by events like that, where you can really just go along and, anyone can register and you can make things and share what you've made, what you have to say, whether it's political or not. But I, as far as I know, the first and only person to be banned from the Wellington Zine Fest. So I'm pretty much so banned in this country that the term free speech doesn't even really mean anything to me. Like I'm quite aware that, even people who, promote free speech or run free speech unions and stuff don't tend to have all that much interest in what happens when women get basically so pushed out of the public sphere that they can't they're stuck at home, you know, their voice is nowhere to be found, you know, like free speech tends to be a defense that's used for people who already have a platform that they want to maintain. And I'm kind of going off on a tangent now, but I don't have much of a voice in New Zealand, and so I really appreciate being able to speak with people like you and stay connected and stay part of these kinds of conversations that way. Yeah, so thank you for having me.
Of course. I wanted to talk a little bit about your book series, which you've recently put out, called the Brief Complete Herstory series. This is such a perfect example of your big idea thinking, you know, that this project, it tackles from the Big Bang, starting from the Big Bang, the origins of life. You know, you compare the life-giving ability of women to the ocean, as though we're all kind of carrying around this ocean inside of us. And then you kind of expand on towards the modern day. So I wonder if you could explain, you know, what was your inspiration for this project in the first place? And if you could, as you've so brilliantly summed up the entire history of life, if you could explain your series in this way too.
Yeah, sure. So as far as inspiration goes, I feel like I wasn't really inspired so much to make this series. It was more like a compulsion. So I had been trying to piece together some kind of overarching narrative since I was a kid. I was trying to find a starting point. Like, I have all these little diaries and notebooks where if I went back through them, I would be able to see myself trying and failing like for years until I found feminism. Because until that point, I couldn't really find an entry point into history, into making it really click for me, into making it make sense for me. I couldn't find the general overarching story that I wanted. And I didn't want it because I need like a narrative to be true or something like that. But it's more that I feel like it's natural for people to want to have a starting point that's very broad, that you can then work with and add to and amend and complicate over your life. And so I've always kind of felt like I've needed that so much that, I used to study and tutor art history. And while I was doing that, I was keeping history scrapbooks where I was trying to also create this stylized historical narrative. Then when I started reading radical feminist literature, it just started coming together. And actually, the time that I got banned from the zine fest, I was making I had one little zine which was just full of feminist quotes and little drawings, which are really bad because I was making them really quickly because I was reading really fast and I was trying to share what I was reading but not get caught up in the making of things because the reading and research was so important to me. So that's one of the things that I was banned for was like early versions of what I've ended up making with this series. And then the inspiration came in the making rather than to make it. It was once I started reading feminist literature, it's more the voices and the content and the histories that these women present are also really energizing and motivating. And obviously, well, my biggest influence was Monica Sho, The Great Cosmic Mother. So that is a really comprehensive historic narrative, which also has a lot of depth that I just really love and have returned to over and over. And it also begins, one of the opening lines is, in the beginning was a very female sea. So she talks about the sea as being like amniotic fluid and like a womb where creatures are gestated and inside. And then I look at also Rachel Carson, whose writing is just beautiful as well. And they both make the same comparison and talk about how when land life emerged, we had to recreate the life-giving conditions of the sea inside our body. So I found that that was like a beautiful, I hadn't thought about that before. And so that's the way that feminist literature kind of gave me an entry into history that I hadn't previously had, because you don't tend to get that kind of magic from dry scientific texts or from, you know, patriarchal histories about war and war after war after war. Yeah,
that's beautiful and really poetic, and that's struck me as well about your book. So your series goes through seven books, right? So starting with this, The Origin of Life, and then going into matriarchy, the creation of patriarchy, religion, and then coming up to neoliberalism. So I wanted to talk with you a bit more about religion and the comparison there between transgenderism. You have this great quote that I really enjoyed that says, "One thing that is clear to me is that the idea that men can become women is not new. It began when patriarchal religions insisted that God, the creator of life, is male. Before this, if God had a sex, it was commonly female, she who birthed the world." Sometimes I think some of the most sort of obvious things can be the most striking or truth-telling, but this isn't obvious to a lot of people, I suppose. So could you describe the shift that took place as these religious practices incorporated a male God as opposed to the female?
Yeah. And there's definitely, in describing that, I kind of feel like jumping back and forth a little bit 5,000 years, because I had to think about that in order to understand transgenderism. Like, I don't think that transgenderism is actually comprehensible at all unless you go back to this point and unless you understand the way that patriarchal religions don't just fabricate a story about male power, but actually distort very human spiritual impulses. And that is something that I think needed to happen for patriarchy to really get a hold into the human psyche. And I think that what we're seeing with transgenderism is kind of like the fallout from that hold, you know, taking place over like 5,000 years. And I think in order for us to respond to it properly, we really do have to understand that, because otherwise what tends to happen, as we were talking about just briefly earlier, is that we, you know, some often transgenderism kind of gets treated, for those who are concerned about it, as like a single issue, some really strange phenomenon that kind of, you know, might have started emerging late last century, but really has only gained momentum in the last 10 years or so. We blame academia and we blame left-wing activists with green and pink hair who honestly just do not have the power. They don't. Like, they might be annoying, but they really don't have the power to create this kind of global corporate state-sanctioned phenomenon. They don't. So I think that when we don't look broadly or deeply enough, we misdiagnose the problem, and then our responses will reflect the fact that we haven't fully grappled with, firstly, the nature of the problem, but also the depth and scale of it. So what happens when you learn about the creation of patriarchy and patriarchal religions, which I've learned a lot about from Gerda Lerner. So in the second book of my series, I draw on her work, and that one's called Matriarchy and the Creation of Patriarchy. I'll add as well that I've now condensed all of the seven volumes into one ebook, so second book, but it's all the same now as well. Yeah, so there's a section called Matriarchy and the Creation of Patriarchy, which talks about the way that human beings organized originally before this thing called patriarchy emerged. And that has a lot to do with, you know, the idea of the if there is a, if you could call it a creator of life, or this life energy being connected to you know, the female and the womb. And we once lived in a way that reflected that. And so one of the books I read about that, I might be jumping around a bit, is called Societies of Peace. I'm not sure if you've heard of that anthology. So Heide Guttner-Abendroth, she's the editor, and it's an anthology of essays by mainly by Indigenous women, but also some anthropologists, about matriarchal societies, and talking about just specific examples of, you know, this is what the culture looks like, and this is how we trace their genealogy. And it's, you know, the genealogy is traced through the mother's line because everyone comes out of their mother. Like, it's just logical. It's not like some kind of feminist, you know, utopian fantasy or like vengeance fantasy matriarchy, you know. It's just like, it's very natural and logical that we would, you know, organize ourselves according to the fact that we come out of the mother. You know, women therefore have a voice in the community. Women therefore are not routinely abused. Obviously, that's going to have intergenerational effects, aside from the fact that it's just wrong, and so forth. So, when we lived that way, and I don't also think that it's just a feminist bias to think that we did. I think this is even, you know, Marx and Engels talked about matriarchy. Looks pretty mainstream idea, I would say, in history. I don't think it's overly contested or contentious. But so when we lived this way, spiritual traditions, and if you want to call them religious traditions, reflected the fact. So there was a reverence for women. We are miraculous. Like, we can, I mean, it's not just that we can create human beings inside of our bodies, but the fact of being alive and human is amazing enough. But, you know, women are revered as creators of life. And there's all sorts of incredible different examples of how these matriarchal philosophies might express or manifest. They're quite diverse. Merlin Stone has a book called When God Was a Woman, and she writes about how, you know, there is so much diversity. Like, she's, you know, one culture might say that the goddess might be associated with the moon, and another one she might be associated with the sun, and another one it's both. And, you know, there's a lot of diversity, but the commonality is, yeah, just the status of women. And also this kind of holistic idea about spirit and life, and what is education, and what, you don't have this compartmentalization that you have with patriarchy, where schooling is one thing and the legal system is another thing, and science is another thing. You've got this observation of nature, mother nature, learning to watch mother nature is what science is, it's what education is, and it's also the basis of law, because natural law is also the law that you have to honor in community life. So there's not all this false distinctions. And then, so in the creation of patriarchy, when Gerda Lerner talks about the various stages that had to be passed through for patriarchy to be established, what she says is that the first thing that happened was that men took possession of children. So cultures that were previously matrilineal became patrilineal, and that's where you get what we have now. Most people are named after their fathers, even though they came out of their mothers, which is actually quite a strange, counterintuitive thing. And then the next thing that happened which you can see can kind of logically follow, is that the cultures became patrilocal. So rather than growing up on your mother's land and having then a birthright to that land and an ancestral connection to that land, like women marry into a husband's clan kind of as part and parcel of his ownership of the children. And she is therefore vulnerable in that situation because the people around her don't have the same, they don't know her like her family does. They don't have the same investment in her well-being. Her partner's bigger and stronger than her and, you know, doesn't necessarily have her best interests at heart. And because she has a child, she can't easily leave. So there's this kind of recipe for entrapment, oppression. And then Gerda Lerner talks about how it's gradually after this you get the formation of the state and legal codes. And she talks about how the earliest legal codes, just how much they emphasize the sexual regulation of women. So the relationship between women, the legal system, or the things that the legal system will do to women, or the status that it will try and maintain, it's not a marginal issue. Like patriarchy and the legal system are like entwined. We wouldn't need, you know, as I said before, we had these systems. Mother Nature determined the law.
Well, right. Like the first or oldest evidence we have of law is the Code of Hammurabi, right? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but yeah. And in it, it basically designates women as property and then divides them into two categories, right? Public property and private property. And that's one of the first, you know, relics and artifacts we have of codified law. So
yeah, it's really illuminating to read this kind of material. Like it really takes the wool off your eyes in terms of, you know, civilization and what is and isn't reasonable. You know, like as we get socialized into civilization, we learn to use this language of what is reasonable and to accept, you know, the life that we, what is around us is normal. And so when we see crazy things like transgenderism happening, we assume that we can negotiate our way out of it because it's obviously unreasonable. No, the whole system is based on oppression. Like it's not just this isn't an anomaly. So that, and Andrew Dworkin, I'm pretty sure it's in Our Blood, where she says the law is an instrument of religion. So, you know, there's this intimate relationship between patriarchal religion and the law. I like to call it the legal system because the word law to me, law, it's like when we talk about natural law or when we talk about law in science, the word means things that you can't change. Gravity is a law because you can't change it hard as you might try. That's why it's a law, because it can't be changed. But the legal system is a totally different thing. It's completely fabricated. It's completely constructed. We made it. It can be changed. It shouldn't even be there necessarily. You know, like our job is to honor natural law and to be in constant discussion about what that means.
Isn't that interesting, too, when you take it into the context of the fact that natural laws are now being called constructs? It's totally flipped on its head, right? They're now saying, well, just to clarify, you know, the concept that biology, laws of biology themselves are created by society.
Yeah. So this is where I think patriarchal religion actually gets really fascinating. Like if it wasn't so outrageous, it would be so interesting actually as well to look at. I mean, transgenderism has taught me so much. Like when you actually allow yourself, I know this sounds almost like criminal or whatever, but when you allow yourself to be curious about it rather than simply outraged, which can be difficult, it really does teach you so much about the human psyche. Like the capacity for denial is incredible. It is actually incredible. Like the fact that it is even possible to get entire populations of people to deny a reality that they can see themselves in the shower every morning, which is the reality of biological sex. They know they came out of their mother. They know about the, you know, sexual relationships they've had. They know about bodies. We know about bodies. We have bodies. It's not even like COVID. You know what I mean? It's not even like, you know, the media is presenting us with facts and figures and we have to figure out where, the, you know, who do we trust and or what's in the vaccine. You know, like very few people can actually verify that stuff. So it's kind of unsurprising that we're all up, you know, in a mess about talking about it. Transgenderism is different because we can all verify biological sex. Yet there's this massive phenomenon of people denying it. And that's actually astounding. It's amazing. It's really quite fascinating. And the reason why we might do that has got something to do with 5,000 years of patriarchal religion. What I think happens with these religions is they're based on this formula, which is normally referred to as dualism. So they're based on a hierarchy. So they take this, what might have previously been understood in holistic terms, you know, these cultural myths and stories and ideas and philosophies about life and ways of living in which education and law and so forth are not artificially separated. So you have this holistic, not to romanticize it, but hello, you know, we haven't been stupid like for the whole 200,000 years that we've existed, like, you know, it takes that and then it arranges everything into a hierarchy so that you have men on the top, women on the bottom, but also a whole lot of other associations. So men are associated with light, the sky, the conscious mind, you know, bright ideas. I don't know, like all
rationality, you know, over rationality. Emotion.
Yeah. Right?
So science is supposed to be high-minded because it doesn't have feelings or it's objective, right?
Yeah. 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 And yeah, thought, thinking rather than feeling. Yeah. So at the bottom, you have earth rather than sky, you know, the mud. And you have the unconscious rather than conscious, feeling rather than thinking, body rather than the mind, and so forth. You can go on with that for ages. Obviously, race, you know, light skin rather than dark skin. So based on this formula, so my understanding now of patriarchal religion is that the stories and myths are not fabricated. The distortions of earlier stories and myths, and this is something that I think makes the work of Maria Gimbutas, the archaeologist, really fascinating, because she investigated the Neolithic matriarchal cultures of Europe and found that the goddesses that we know about through the Greek classics like Ovid and Homer, like so the goddesses like Hera and Athena and Artemis and Aphrodite, so she basically discovered that the symbol groups that are associated with each of these different goddesses are much older than this patriarchal pantheon. So what happened with the Indo-European invasions, which is often the historic moment, you know, that people attribute the spread of patriarchy to. So what happened with those is that this dualistic formula was kind of applied like a Snapchat filter or something to like these different local religions and philosophies. So then patriarchy doesn't fabricate, patriarchy distorts. And I think that this is really one of its most kind of interesting, if you can say so, aspects. It can't fabricate because the human spirit is such that we have these deep-seated needs and longings, like for meaning, for belonging, for, you know, love and so forth. And so in order to be meaningful to us, these religions, patriarchal religions, have to appeal to those deep-seated longings, but kind of twist them so that the same needs and longings and values can be used to get us to identify with the socially prescribed, dualistic, sanctioned, quit things.
I wanted to ask you a question really quick, actually. When you were describing about the kind of goddess figures that we associate with Greek mythology and so on, Greek mythology having its own sort of obviously patriarchal ideas about women, you'd said something that was interesting, that those patriarchal aspects, or the kind of maybe more misogynist aspects, were sort of stamped over top of this culture and mythology that was already existing. Is that right?
Kind of. I use the metaphor of a Snapchat filter, but mm-hmm. that's just me. It's probably not the best metaphor, because I think it's not superimposed. It's really like a twisting, you know.
I just think that's really interesting, because we're just seeing history repeat itself again, aren't we, with the gender ideology, right? I mean, they'll take, for example, the hijra in India to say that, you know, see, this has always been the case, when actually the hijra is something quite different from the Western trans woman or whatever identity that's going on in the West, right? So they kind of stamp over on top of to other cultures.
I mean, the whole idea of sexual freedom that transgenderism purports to promote is actually a really deep-seated need and longing within the human being. And we are so disconnected from what that actually means, because it's been so long since many of us have lived it, that we're susceptible to weird ideas about what it might be. But also, the interesting thing about patriarchal religions is that, as we know, they don't just provide a template for how society and institutions are structured, and kind of social systems of power, like, you know, men are in charge of the government, men are in charge of religion, men are in charge of, you know, the household, this is how it runs. But they also provide a model for how our psyche is supposed to operate. So, you know, for women, the man in charge is like, he's the one who gives us a moral code, but there's also, you know, the internalized male gaze, and then you have this repressed woman inside. So it's almost like there's this fractalizing effect, where you have this dualistic model template, and you can look at kind of any given, I don't know, country or community, and see that it's patriarchal and it roughly fits that template. But then you can broaden it out so that when you look at the world, you can see how the superpowers treat, you know, like, or colonization is like a bigger, it's like that dualistic framework applied on a bigger scale. But then it also gets applied on the most minute scale. So within the individual, you have the inner critic, or the inner police, or the inner kind of, you know, however we understand God, we kind of treat ourselves accordingly. And so we have repression, and that repression that we have inside ourselves mirrors the way that particular people within society are deemed to be, you know, undesirable or whatever. So there's like this template applies to the human psyche as much as it applies to society. And that's why entire populations are buying into this stuff, because we've been conditioned to accept this patriarchal dualistic way of thinking since we came out of the womb. Before that, like, obviously it's intergenerational, it's bigger than us. So we are born into the society, we're conditioned to accept male rule, male identification. That leads to all kinds, along with, you know, I think, you know, you've written about this too, like pornography Rape leads to dissociation on an individual level, but then when you have pornography, which is rape on tape, as a cultural phenomenon, you have dissociation becomes a cultural phenomenon too. But, you know, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit now, but it already is, just by virtue of conditioning, just by virtue of social conditioning to a patriarchy. We have to repress aspects of ourselves, and it leads to this kind of semi-dissociation. And it is because of that that we can accept, I am not my body. You know, that person's obviously a man, but he says he's a woman. I'm going to have to accept that, first of all, because I can accept that person has a different identity than their, you know, that their body, that they're different from their body. But secondly, it's a man, so I better accept what he tells me. So I feel like, and this is not just obviously something that's happened recently, this is really something that couldn't even have happened several years after, you know, the creation of the state or something like that. This is almost like a logical endpoint of 5,000 years of distorted, patriarchal, dualistic philosophy being entrenched in public institutions, being part and parcel of the socialization of children, of human beings, being part and parcel of the human ego. So I think once you look at it like that, it becomes a bit more difficult to be like, hey, we just need to write lots of letters to the local MP, politician. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I often look at the various ways that activists are trying to respond, and I'm like, no, you know, I can't say what is and isn't effective or worth doing or legitimate, but I do think that, you know, Gerda Lerner talks about, I can't remember if it's the creation of patriarchy or the creation of feminist consciousness, she talks about how one tragic consequence of 5,000 years of patriarchy is that it has basically, that it's put women on the defense for that entire time. So we're locked into this state of negotiation, whether it's in the household or whether it's in politics. And we're always trying to argue for our right to say anything to begin with, blah, 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 blah. And so whether or not we want to continue that strategy forever and ever is a big question. And I think...
I could just jump in here for a second, sure. Because I'm totally in agreement with you. And this is not meant to be disparaging in any way, but it's just my personal feeling that, you know, I start to, after having been involved in this in some capacity for over 5 years, 6 years now, maybe, I do start to see the same kinds of patterns, you know, where you see the first beginning signs of opposition to this ideology, right? And one of the first things that women tend to do is, you know, say, I reject the word cis, which is great and it's fine. I do find that by repeating even the rejection of the word cis, we are repeating that in our minds and using it in our minds when it's an inherently dissociative tactic, right? Because in order to think of ourselves as women, we then have to think about ourselves as cis women, which is putting us in relationship to what men think of us. So I do understand what you're saying here about, you know, the strategies or the bigger picture of what we're really dealing with. And, you know, just saying that for myself, some of you, especially some of your work, has been really enlightening on that front. And yeah, the pornography thing, I cannot get over how huge that is. I wish more people would talk about the dissociation, the real, the fact that it's inducing this kind of trauma. You know, it is causing people to split from themselves to construct a false self, which is, really worrying.
I mean, I have never watched pornography in my life. I'm in my late 30s and I somehow have managed to dodge that bullet. Yet when I was in high school, and again, I'm in my late 30s, that was a little while ago. That was before everyone had cell phones. actually, my first year of high school was like, the internet was a brand new thing. Like, you know, we had a school computer. Like, it was, in a way, it's like ancient history. And the boys watched pornography, which, you know, and I felt like I was saturated in it, because they would treat me accordingly. So I felt very exposed to pornography without ever having watched it, and it had that effect on me, dissociation. Like, I spent a lot of time in high school feeling afraid. I didn't know how to cope with being looked at and spoken to in this porn-influenced way. One thing the boys used to do is kind of like introduce me to terms, so that, you know, they ask you if you want to spit roast later or something like that. And then it's not only degrading, but it's meant to be absolutely hilarious that you don't know what it means. So you're kind of being cornered in multiple ways. It's like, well, I don't get how there's actually something embarrassing about not knowing that stuff. But at the time, I felt really bewildered. And I knew that that was what made me the joke. And so that is partly what led me to just feel more and more dissociated. So, you know, we often associate dissociation with trauma that comes from, you know, like physical violence, and especially, well, it's mainly associated with rape and combat, like war. But then pornography is another one. But then I didn't even watch it. And so the cultural phenomenon of dissociation is not to be underestimated. And that is, you know, I've talked about transgenderism as a form of disaster capitalism and said, you know, Naomi Klein argues that, you know, that's what neoliberalism is. There's some form of disaster within a culture, whether it's military disaster or, you know, a military invasion or a natural disaster. And then that gets taken advantage of while everyone's in a state of disorientation. Hey, you know, we're going to claim this land now, so do the cleanup. And then, you know, next minute everything's corporatized. And yeah, well, often when people come out with really good big ideas like that, that are main, you know, have some mainstream recognition, they don't apply those ideas to patriarchy or to women. But it's quite easy to do. And so you can see how pornography has created these disaster conditions, which have led us to become even more susceptible. We're susceptible enough to the idea that, yeah, men can be women, and to transgenderism. So, yeah, I mean, when you take all of this into account, is that I think it's actually quite difficult to go back to that default response of like negotiation, because you just can see that this isn't something that can be negotiated with. Like, this is so deep. You know, I kind of liken that to trying to negotiate someone out of like a drug or alcohol addiction. You know, you can have all the best arguments, you can be really desperate, but they're not in it because they think it's a good idea. Just the nature of the hold is much different than that. Yeah.
I've kind of been wondering too, you sort of mentioned this a little bit, I think, in the beginning about the human need for believing in something or something to that effect, where I've been kind of seeing perhaps this as a replacement for religion in some sense, where, as you so described very well, the patriarchal religions that were being set up, but then now we have, I guess, kind of pornography being sort of the propaganda of this ideology in some ways. Well, I mean, it's certainly not the only, not the only aspect. I mean, there's academia as well, but yeah, I wonder what your thoughts on that are, you know, how this belief system can take the place of religion, or be put on top of the spirituality?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Over the last few years, the more I have probably related and unrelated to this, over the last couple of years, I've become more and more spiritually inclined myself. So, and I don't really think of spirituality as kind of feeding some need to believe in something. I think it's genuine. Like, so anyone who sits down, like, you know, spiritual teachers are always talking about meditation. If you sit down by yourself and allow yourself some stillness and you ask a question like, who am I? And you ask that question authentically, it's like a portal, like it's a portal into what Thich Nhat Hanh calls into being, that we are not what patriarchy tells us we are, these finite individual ego identities. We are inextricably connected with the whole of life. You know, breathing and eating and just being alive, your body is part of this huge living organism that is the planet. And I see the recognition of that as kind of a way of living rather than sort of like a belief system. We, you know, we can either choose to live in accordance with into being and to explore it and to celebrate it, or we can deny it. And that's when you need to have belief systems to substitute for them. So like ideology to substitute. And that's when you need to kind of believe, because it takes an effort, you know, like it doesn't take an effort to realize you're part of nature if you live that way. But one of the consequences of cutting us off from nature and from one of the consequences of dissociation is the creation of the ego, is the creation of this kind of individual finite identity that people have to hold on to and protect manically, because nobody else has my best interests at heart. I'm on my own. And you know, there's many many other reasons, I think, why, you know, the patriarchal household, the way that mothers are unduly stressed within patriarchy, also leads to this kind of what's often called learned helplessness, which makes us extra defensive and extra ego oriented. And that's, I think, what leads us to grasp onto all these kinds of substitutes for just the recognition of into being, which is what we would otherwise be experiencing, I think. I often suspect that I sound like I'm being very like romantic about the way things could be or the way things would be, but in my own mind it's logical. Like I'm just like, I'm quite sure that we didn't spend the first, you know, 100 200,000 years of our existence in this crazed egomaniacal state, because we wouldn't have been able to survive like that. You know, in organized warfare and patriarchy and rape, like how long would we have survived? We evolve from the primates, we become Homo sapiens sapiens, we start raping and murdering each other, like before, you know. No, this isn't part of human nature, this is part of patriarchal society. Like, I don't think I'm being romantic.
Adrienne Mayer wrote a book called The Amazons, where she explores sort of the archaeological evidence for Amazon warriors and some of the myths that were associated with them. But she has this great line in there about how she says, like, oppression is a luxury of settled people, or something like that, where she was saying that basically during the hunter-gatherer or nomadic periods of human history, men and women were generally pretty much equal, at least definitely much more so than they would be today. But I was thinking about that in terms of what you were saying. So
it was interesting as well, the connection between you know, when you read about matriarchy and you read about the kind of integral connection that people have with the land, just by virtue of being born on their mother's lands, and, you know, the when I've read again about matriarchal cultures, it's like one of the examples of the way that people might have lived isn't, well, did live, maybe even do still. I'm kind of ignorant about how many of such cultures have managed to, you know, last through globalization and colonization and neoliberalism and whatnot. But longhouses is one of the ways, one of the one typical kind of matriarchal setup. So you have mothers and living with sisters and grandmothers and children, and then within the matriline, brothers are also recognized, and there's this kind of communal living within these longhouses. So motherhood is also socialized. So a lot of so a whole generation of women will be called mothers, even if they don't have their own biological children. And that's partly how you get this maiden mother crone life cycle thing, that, you know, it's not because you have to have children, it's just that is a generational thing. I don't have my own children. I have no intention of having my own children. I often feel sad that I'm not more connected to my friends' kids, especially when they're like super stressed raising kids, and I'm like, well, give them to me. But often, you know, it's just in this culture, it's like a logistical whatever. But at some point, that was a natural thing. You didn't have a soul, you know, like a mother trying to raise kids ultimately and essentially by herself, really stressed out. I can't remember what led me talking about this, but
I feel the same way. I often feel like, well, if I could just borrow someone else's children for a little bit and then, you know, read some stories with them or something, then I would feel fulfilled, you know, like that would be enough for me. And it seems kind of a shame that that's not
The alienation of like women like you and I, like from women who sometimes, you know, like I'll mention to friends, like, I just give me, like, I want to just give me your children. Like, I'd love to hang out with them. And they're like, really? Like, I don't know. But
I mean, it's so much work too. It's so much work. And then it's just expected for women to totally sacrifice themselves. You know, there's this concept of the self-sacrificing mother who even loses her own identity, her own desires, for the sake of raising children. But in what it does is then it frees men up to go ahead and go about what they want to do. And then they also get to claim the child as, you know, with their name, like you said before. So it's just, it's quite the system, huh? The whole system is just this splitting and splitting and splitting. It reminds me, when I'm talking with you, I'm always kind of thinking about, you know, books that I've read that have this common themes that we're talking about. And I was thinking of Women in Nature, right? Susan Griffin. God, that's one of my favorites. I just love it. I mean, some people might find it a bit difficult to read because she has so many references, right? First of all, she references like 200 materials or something within that book, and goes through and shows how from the very beginning the splitting that happens. It's so hard to explain, but you know what I mean. People who haven't read it don't know what I mean. I mean the splitting of self and nature, of the splitting that happens in science, the reason, emotion, all of that kind of stuff. And you were expressing before, you know, that that's kind of what the root of this transgenderism might be related to possibly. And I was thinking about also the patriarchal reversals, right? That Mary Daly talks about, the patriarchal reversal that men create life. That's one of the biggest and most sort of obvious patriarchal reversals that we can think of, right? That, you know, what, women don't give birth to life, like God made everyone and not a woman, right? But I mean, God, do you ever just think about how many patriarchal reversals are in gender ideology to begin with? I mean,
it's based on them. One of the ones that I at some point started to really consider as well does actually relate to these matriarchal cultures and living arrangements, because, you know, as we know, like, postmodernism was at least in part a backlash to the rise of women's studies within academia. Like, it's no coincidence that postmodernism came in and women's studies was pushed out and replaced with gender studies. And so part and parcel of that was not just the erasure of women's studies and women's history, but the distortion of it. So all of these ideas that women, you know, it used to be women who cared about pronouns, in the sense that when we saw he everywhere, we didn't go, no, that's not an incidental, meaningless thing. Oh, you mean everyone. Okay, I'll just accept that. This is a patriarchal narrative. You know, like, we would look at the meaning behind that kind of stuff. And now it's like, okay, like, it's some sort of cruel plot twist where the stuff that we tried to draw attention to. And so one thing that feminists critiqued in women's studies and in the second wave of feminist movement that women's studies came out of was the family. So we talked about the family as being constructed. But I think a lot of people have real trouble understanding how and what that means, because it takes a man and a woman to make a kid. So, you know, how is that constructed? But they don't want to say that they don't know what that means, because it makes them look highly conservative or something, not very progressive, because, it, you know, it's like, we know there's a problem, but if this is also a natural phenomenon, how am I meant to critique it? Like, you have to know a little bit about the creation of patriarchy and a little bit about matriarchal cultures and different ways of, you know, social organizing. So now we're being presented with this idea that, oh, okay, the family is constructed. So therefore, why not just create a different one through having a pregnant man or through surrogacy, or, you know, like, if we constructed this one, why not construct another? And so that's like what I would call a distortion of a feminist idea or a feminist critique, a woman's, you know, like, something that women are trying to draw attention to. And because it's not just an intellectual idea, because it comes from this deep-seated longing within human beings to live differently, it can be used and twisted to be like, how about this, how about that, because, you know, we didn't really I think not enough people have been exposed to feminism and to the real substance and meaning of a lot of feminist critiques. They just got twisted.
These days on social media, I see a lot of particularly men, not only men, but mostly men that interact with me anyway, saying that, you know, feminism is to blame for all of this, so we may as well just sit back and enjoy it, right? I mean, and part of the problem with that too, obviously, is that it conflates basically Judith Butler with, like, all feminist movements throughout history and time and everywhere, which is just ridiculous and absurd. But yeah, but also that distortion that you're talking about, like, once you see it, once you see one of those, I mean, it happened for me where when I recognized one, I just started seeing a lot of them. I mean, is there any bigger distortion than women saying, you know, hey, we're treated as second class citizens in society, and then to take that and jump with, well, men are the most oppressed women, actually. I mean, like, it's astounding. Sometimes people might have this belief or view that patriarchy is not intentional, that, okay, maybe if it exists, it came about as sort of a natural progression. But once you start to see things like that, you know, that the kind of hall of mirrors or the distortions that you're talking about, it just seems quite deliberate. I mean, we know it's deliberate, but to see that language, the way it's used in this intentional way to distort what women are saying, it's like an abusive relationship. It's like, no, I said this, why didn't you hear what I'm saying? You only choose to hear what benefits you, or what you want to hear, right?
Yeah. I think that's a really fascinating idea or question about whether it's deliberate. I think I spent a long time looking at it as though it was, like, I think the longest time that I've been a feminist, I've been looking at this as though it is deliberate. But the more I've looked into the kind of the nature of the human ego, the nature of conditioning, what spiritual teachers actually mean when they say that we're acting unconsciously, that it's not an excuse, it's not a cop-out, it's just that pain is the only explanation for this kind of madness. Like, healthy people, sane people don't act like this. And the level of pain that you have to be in to gaslight women and say, you know, I'm a woman when you're a man, and or just force them to comply when other men say whatever. That doesn't come from a sane, enlightened mind. And a mind that isn't, like, I don't want to sound woke. And I myself am absolutely not enlightened, but a mind that's not enlightened acts in ways that are unconscious. It acts in ways that are conditioned. It acts in ways that are predictably patterned along, you know, socially prescribed lines. And so when you look at it that way, it becomes kind of moot, like whether it's deliberate or not, to me is kind of not all that. It's kind of like a secondary question. It certainly sustains oppression. And there's definitely, like, if someone wants to maintain their privilege and dig their heels in, then they will, you know, they'll do that. And but how conscious is that? I don't know. It's limited. Like, a fully conscious person doesn't, I don't think, behave in those kinds of crazy, crazy ways.
Well, I suppose I meant deliberate in the sense that it's
not accidental.
Yeah. Maybe if you talk about the sort of psychoanalytic reasons behind it, then that's something different. But I mean, certainly we can see that, you know, the history of, for example, the medical abuse of women and things like this were choices that were made. So there are choices being made here.
And it hasn't all got to do with misguided good intentions.
Right. Exactly.
That you can kind of educate people out of. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. I feel like that should be abundantly clear at this stage, actually.
Yeah.
Like, oh, whoops, I thought I was supporting the most oppressed people on the planet. I'm so glad that you just informed me that that's not what's happening. Gosh. I actually also recently, I've decided, this is kind of a tangent, but you know how there's, like, these kind of laws that people have to follow? Oh, no. Or these kind of suggested principles for, like, logic or debating, like there's, like, Occam's razor, you know, like you should use the simplest argument, or, you know, different kind of principles like that. And I have one that I learned from transgenderism, and I don't know if it already exists, but I think it should, that you should never debate someone on their terms if they contradict themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, if somebody says biological sex is not real, but then 5 minutes later, they're going to say, this man needs sex reassignment surgery so that he can have a fake vagina, therefore be a real woman, which is actually a distorted assertion that biological sex is real. Then you shouldn't spend any time trying to convince them that sex is real because they just conceded it themselves. Like, I feel like there's so much of this goes on as well within, like, people's responses to transgenderism. Like, I feel like it would pay for us to not react quite so you know, like, readily and quickly as we sometimes do, and just kind of let, you know, that there's a friend of mine does Aikido, and there's this principle in Aikido where you don't try and outmuscle your opponent, you try and get them to use their mass and energy against themselves. I think we could be doing a lot more of that.
I agree completely. What it does is it's a it saps your energy. It just takes the energy out of you, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel that's kind of the point of all of this anyway, because these circular arguments, they just get you to run laps, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're too tired to do any other kind of work, right? You know? So like, and then, and it attaches itself. And by it, I'm still talking about transgenderism or that ideology anyway, but it attaches itself to these other things that it starts, you can see pulling in the pornography, pulling in the prostitution, pulling in all of these other aspects of women's oppression and taking it on as its own, purporting that these things are empowering or good for women in some capacity. So as it keeps doing that, it's like expanding out. I see it in that kind of way. And then we lose more opportunities. We lose more of our chance to combat those other aspects that are really important for liberating women. Mm. And so
but
if we
think about what that means, you know, I feel like so many of us invest so much energy in the running laps, like you said, that we don't even give ourselves a minute to think about what liberation actually means to us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's a big question too, you know. And it's worth spending time on, for sure. And the jury is out. Like, I feel like different political paradigms have different answers to offer that question. There's spirituality. Radical feminists don't tend to really like that much spirituality. We have a mixed relationship to it. I think it's actually up to every individual to figure out what liberation means to them. And I think that that's a pretty good idea if you're going to spend your life in activism in the name of liberation, to actually know what you mean. Because otherwise I think that you'll be prone to reactivity and to being kind of like cued, you know, like, and I see this across the political spectrum, actually. Like, this isn't just a feminist thing, obviously. I do think that, like you what you were saying before about when we were talking about motherhood, I was thinking, you know, you were talking about that self-sacrificing state that motherhood in a patriarchal society kind of forces women into, but then that becomes the model for femininity, and that becomes a model for how to be a good person, especially if you're a woman. And I often feel like, you know, feminism in principle opposes that, but the thing about politicizing is it doesn't automatically override your conditioning. So a lot of women take their self-sacrificing conditioning into feminism and then create this kind of burnout culture within feminism, which is like, have you written all your letters to the politicians this week? And like, you know, like, everyone's working really hard and there's this kind of language of hard work and struggle for the cause. And it's not about like being a proper feminist or anything like that. I just think that it's worth taking a minute to check whether what's in operation right now. Is this how I've been conditioned to behave? Or is this actually what I truly believe is the path to liberation? You know, it's worthwhile to think about. But I think that across the political sphere, like, one thing I'm really aware of is, you know, I don't watch television. Like, I'm, you know, I read books, and other than that, I'm kind of almost shielded from any media almost to a fault. Like, I would have to get people to tell me if we were in lockdown or something like that. Like, I just kind of don't want the man to have constant access to my nervous system, so I expose myself to very much media. But, you know, you notice that, like, if Greta Thunberg is on the television, like, probably there's going to be a climate change strike, like, this weekend, or if a black man gets murdered by a white police officer in the United States, then we're going to be talking about racism and marching this weekend and taking a knee in the square, you know, like, So we're being queued, which isn't how things would be operating. You know, if, for instance, Black Lives Matter was a big grassroots movement, then it would be expressing in all sorts of diverse ways, because it would be emerging out of, you know, people's individual commitment to, you know, against racism and for freedom. And that would, yeah, that would have multiple expressions. I think in New Zealand, we would be talking a lot more about the genocide that's happening in West Papua, for example. There's this pattern, which is like, when this kind of a person says this kind of a thing, when a Hollywood producer gropes an actress, then it's Me Too movement, women on the streets, you know. And transgenderism, it's the same thing. Okay, some guy is in the Olympics, like, representing women in sports. Okay, I don't like it. I think it's worthy of a response, but I think we should also be conscious of the extent to which we're being cued, and mm-hmm. and to which that means that actually the system is perfectly capable of accommodating movements that operate that way. Like, it just is. So
yeah, I kind of wonder sometimes too if some of that backlash energy, some of the resistance, is where it gets its power from in the first place, because you'll notice that people will share things that they disagree with. Well, then you've just, you know, linked through to somebody else's work that they'll get money for. So you're kind of supporting it in within resisting it in that way, you know, performative, whatever you want to call it, you know. But I mean, it's the same thing with, like you said, the performativity of politics, of transgenderism is like the performativity of identity, essentially, right? So it cuts to the root of that. So what we see the extensions of that in our actions. I was recently reading The Society of the Spectacle. Have you read that? It's very, very interesting. So I've only actually read the first part, and then I just stopped because my mind was like blown away, you know, and I was like, wait a minute, I need to sit on that for a second and think about it some more. But it's just really good. He talks about how identity has become from doing, so an action, right? Where we used to get kind of our last names from our work or a job that we did or something like that, then into having, so possessing and ownership. And then identity coming from performing or being seen.
Yeah.
So as a spectacle, right? So
yeah. And that's an essay from like the 60s, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's before like Instagram, you know, if it's not on Instagram, it didn't happen. Yeah.
It's so relevant to wow. all of this, I think. Yeah.
And that's, I've been doing lots of exploration recently into the relationship between feminism and spirituality. So I know that there are particular writers who've done some pretty epic takedowns of like Eckhart Tolle, The Power of Now, people like Louise Hay, you know, You Can Heal Your Life, but also the general flavor of I guess freedom being something that's attainable for an individual, you know, like a lot of these figures like Tolle and people like Krishnamurti, who have entered the state of fearlessness, which is essentially freedom. So they then kind of automatically promote this idea that freedom is attainable for the individual. And I think a lot of feminists are quite allergic to that idea because it goes against not only the whole premise of collectivism, but also the material reality, because, you know, these spiritual teachers encourage us to think of ourselves as being not essentially material. But I think the kind of what you're talking about, the society, the spectacle, all of that stuff really does mean that I think we have to look again. I think we have to look again at some of these spiritual teachings, because I think that the only way out of those kinds of that kind of social pressure and those kinds of social patterns and that ego-driven stuff, because that's what it is. And it not to stigmatize that idea of ego, you know, is it like it's fashionable to do that, but I don't even mean it like that. It's just like the, you know, the individual identity. Like, if you want to get beyond that, you have to listen to some of these people. Well, they can help. So I feel very strongly about that at the moment, that there is a different kind of relationship between feminism and those kinds of spiritual teachings than might first appear, and that would be worthwhile for us to look more deeply into where some of the connections might be, rather than just some of the disconnections. It doesn't have to be like seeing freedom as something that's attainable for the individual. Basically, seeing wokeness is a real thing. Like, I think wokeness is a real thing. Like, you can quote me. Like, you know, like it is possible. It's not necessarily, you know, to attain a state that goes beyond just the conditioned mind. And I don't think that that means that we need to throw out looking at external reality or material reality or collective reality. So I feel like once we understand that those aren't mutually exclusive ideas, we can be more receptive to some of the spiritual teachings. And I think that would actually enhance a lot of the things that we do as activists. But it also has to do with what we've kind of been talking about, you know, the habit of negotiation and the habit of defensiveness and the habit of, you know, and the risk that of manipulation and the society of the spectacle stuff. This is all based on the conditioning. And, you know, also we've been talking about the way that transgenderism is only possible because of dissociation, because of the condition of the human psyche at present. So it's not simply a corporate phenomenon. It's not simply a state, you know, a matter of legislation. It wouldn't be possible for it to just be those things if most of the human population wasn't susceptible to believing these ideas, or to if it couldn't get a hook into us. So the question of how it gets a hook into us is equally important as the question of who's benefiting, I think. Especially at this stage where people are just letting it roll over us, you know. But once you start looking at this factor, this very important element of conditioning, which is to say the ego, the way we condition shapes our identities, that's the ego. Well, it automatically leads to the question, how do you get beyond that? That's what the spiritual teachers talk about. So if we rule that out as activists, if we don't want to go there because it seems like they promote something like individual freedom, wokeness, if we don't want to go there because of that, we might have cut off a really important source of, all sorts of things, energy, insight, name it. Like, yeah. I guess it might be worth mentioning, like, one of the books that has really, really helped me in terms of thinking about how to get beyond this reactivity negotiation pattern is The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner. Have you read it?
I haven't.
I feel it changed my life, and I actually found it randomly in a secondhand bookshop. I had never heard of it. So I'm always grateful for the fact that book found its way into my life. It's so good. It's a book for women. I think it's from like 1989, and it's based around looking at family dynamics and interpersonal relationships, and how they operate according to patterns, and basically how to break patterns. It's kind of like how to assert yourself within your relationships, not aggressively, but like, you know, how to end the habit of repression, etc. I won't go into it too much detail, but I find it just as politically relevant as it is personally relevant. Like, if you read this book, like reading that book made me so much more literate in terms of political dynamics and backlash and gaslighting tactics. And one thing that Lerner talks about as being the alternative to reactivity, and this is something a lot of spiritual teachers actually talk about, is that you need to get, so responsibility is the alternative. So she defines that phrase as meaning, she talks about how responsibility is not this kind of like your burden of moral obligations that you carry, that you have to do all these things. It's not that. It's your ability to respond. So this is a necessarily conscious, chosen, creative thing, you know, and it also depends on you realizing you can't change the other party. You can't even necessarily change the situation. You can control your response, and in changing your response, situation naturally changes. And that's all that you can do. And once you kind of realize that, you become much more discerning about what you're going to do, because it really becomes a matter of conscious choice, but you also become more conscious of, I think, of the fact that, you know, I've only got one life. The way I respond to this situation, the way I respond to the way the world is today, is what I'm doing with my life. So I'm not just gonna let that kind of flit away through reactivity and actions that aren't necessarily, well, that are not necessarily effective, but also that, you know, 3 years of particular forms of activism, you know, like if I do this similar kinds of stuff for years and years and years, and then this is what I have to show for it, am I going to be, is that the life I want? Like, this idea to me of responsibility kind of helps us realize that that activism is part of our lives, and that, you know, I kind of like the idea that if we think about this more, we would get to have movements that are created out of all our individual responses, creative responses, rather than reactions and default, you know, negotiation habits and stuff like that. I just feel like a lot of spiritual teachers really help to put you in touch with the place where those conscious responses come from. I mean, you know, so many activists are burnt out and could use a stronger connection with that kind of wellspring of action. I've just been thinking more and more that there's a missing connection between feminism and spirituality for me that I feel was worth mentioning.
Put it so well. I've been having some of those same thoughts, you know, but you've just put it so well. Choosing the way that you want to respond to something, right? And choose what you spend your energy on, right?
Yeah. I had a couple of years ago, I kind of came to the end of the road with the way that I had been working as a feminist. I'd been gathering women together for a few years using various tactics, talking to people I knew, but also kind of making a spectacle of myself on the internet and finding women online and then meeting them through that and stuff. And for various reasons, I couldn't continue to do that. I kind of just had a dead end. And that is what forced me to think about what I was doing, what I wanted to do. I got really, really, really sad. and that made me look back and go, okay, so I have to do justice to myself, like as an activist, as a person, whatever, just in any way that I want justice done to me, I have to do it first. So I started thinking about all the things I'd been doing, like heaps of reading, heaps of writing, trying to share my work, being ignored in my own country largely, or, you know, actively silenced, like, you're not allowed here, go away, shut up, you. packs, like bullying packs and all sorts of crazy stuff. So then I kind of started asking myself, what would I have to do with all of this in order to know that it, at least I was doing justice to myself? And that's when I started focusing a lot more on these long-term projects, like the Brief Complete Her Story series, and just deciding to self-publish that come hell or high water, because I knew that I could no longer separate my conscience, my sense of what feminism requires of me, from what I require of me as an individual. Like, I require me to have something to show for the way that I use my time. So I'm hardly online anymore. Like, I don't really engage in the daily event sort of side of things, where I also know that's pretty well covered. So I guess that lesson was so big for me that it's also become something that I talk about quite a lot, because it's just something I'm still kind of living in.
I guess I just kind of wanted to share this quote from an essay of yours that was in Spinning and Weaving. So last year, a woman named Elizabeth Miller put together a publication of radical feminist essays in this anthology. And yours, I believe, is the first or one of the very first essays in that anthology. And I've really appreciated this quote. Women's heartbreak is the most potent force for freedom in this world. Women carry the pain of living under patriarchy, a system in which 1 in 3 women are raped during their lifetime, and over 130 women are murdered each day around the world by men they know. A network of institutions, including the military, prostitution, surrogacy, and marriage, sustain patriarchy and ensure women are overworked, underpaid, and otherwise punished for being female. This heartbreak is the fuel of the women's movement. It represents a longing to know real love, real joy, and real expression in this one wild and precious life. What we call women's movement is the cumulative, ongoing work of individual women who transmute our heartbreak into something creative, something freedom-making, which is kind of what you've just been talking about in general, right?
Yeah. I forgot that I wrote that. I feel like feminism is born out of feeling. Like the trans movement and a lot of the responses that we're used to seeing from women now are very intellectual. Like, we need to remind people what biological sex is. We need to talk about testosterone. We need to deal with this intersex argument and talk about what intersex conditions actually are. And it's kind of like, you know, what you were saying before, like in some way it almost validates the, let's say, opposition, because it suggests that they have a valid argument to respond to, which isn't true. They don't even have an argument. They don't have an argument at all. They just have some crazy combination of pain and entitlement. That's what it is. That's all it is. And when we don't recognize that, we also don't recognize our own, you know, the fact that our response also comes from heartbreaking longing. And for what? For a way of life that I think our bodies remember, even if our minds do not. And I feel like knowing that feminism, the women's movement, arises out of these deep-seated longings, out of feeling, is really important, because if we ask ourselves what we want to do justice to that, I think we would be seeing movements arise that are really creative rather than dominated by the habit of negotiation, which we keep going back to. I think you said something earlier about not wanting to sound disparaging, and I'm always conscious of that too, and I am also conscious of creating false polarization. Like, you know, when you start to really pursue certain ideas or certain insights and they're really enlightening for you, or they're really illuminating, or they really help you, and then in order to explain them, you kind of compare them with an opposite or a pattern that you see. And in doing that, you create this kind of people should do this and everyone's doing that and that's wrong. I'm like very aware of that, but at the same time, you know, it's true. Like the negotiation thing is quite a strong habit. I would just love to see a movement emerge that was much more conscious of the fact that it comes out of feeling and that it comes out of deeply human longings, creative longings, and so forth.
This is Poetry is Not a Luxury from the book Sister Outsider by Audre Lorde, first published in 1984 by Crossing Press. Read by Renee Gerlich. The quality of light by which we scrutinize our lives has direct bearing upon the product which we live and upon the changes which we hope to bring about through those lives. It is within this light that we form those ideas by which we pursue our magic and make it realized. This is poetry as illumination, for it is through poetry that we give name to those ideas which are, until the poem, nameless and formless, about to be birthed, but already felt. That distillation of experience from which true poetry springs births thought as dream births concept, as feeling births idea, as knowledge births, proceeds, understanding. As we learn to bear the intimacy of scrutiny and to flourish within it, as we learn to use the products of that scrutiny for power within our living, those fears which rule our lives and form our silences begin to lose their control over us. For each of us as women, there is a dark place within, where hidden and growing our true spirit rises, quote, beautiful and tough as chestnut stanchions against your nightmare of weakness, unquote, and of impotence. These places of possibility within ourselves are dark because they are ancient and hidden. They have survived and grown strong through that darkness. Within these deep places, each one of us holds an incredible reserve of creativity and power, of unexamined and unrecorded emotion and feeling. The women's place of power within each of us is neither white nor surface. It is dark, it is ancient, and it is deep. When we view living in the European mode only as a problem to be solved, we rely solely upon our ideas to make us free, for these were what the white fathers told us were precious. But as we come more into touch with our own ancient, non-European consciousness of living as a situation to be experienced and interacted with, we learn more and more to cherish our feelings and to respect those hidden sources of our power from where true knowledge and therefore lasting action comes. At this point in time, I believe that women carry within ourselves the possibility for fusion of these two approaches so necessary for survival, and we come closest to this combination in our poetry. I speak here of poetry as a revelatory distillation of experience, not the sterile wordplay that, too often, the white fathers distorted the word poetry to mean in order to cover a desperate wish for imagination without insight. For women, then, poetry is not a luxury. It is a vital necessity of our existence. It forms the quality of light within which we predicate our hopes and dreams towards survival and change, first made into language, then into idea, then into more tangible action. Poetry is the way we help give name to the nameless, so it can be thought. The farthest horizons of our hopes and fears are cobbled by our poems, carved from the rock experiences of our daily lives. As they become known to and accepted by us, our feelings and the honest exploration of them become sanctuaries and spawning grounds for the most radical and daring of ideas. They become a safe house for that difference so necessary to change and the conceptualization of any meaningful action. Right now, I could name at least 10 ideas I would have found intolerable or incomprehensible and frightening, except as they came after dreams and poems. This is not idle fantasy, but a disciplined attention to the true meaning of "it feels right to me." We can train ourselves to respect our feelings and to transpose them into a language so they can be shared. And where that language does not yet exist, it is our poetry which helps to fashion it. Poetry is not only dream and vision, it is the skeleton architecture of our lives. It lays the foundation for a future of change, a bridge across our fears of what has never been before. Possibility is neither forever nor instant. It is not easy to sustain belief in its efficacy. We can sometimes work long and hard to establish one beachhead of real resistance to the deaths we are expected to live, only to have that beachhead assaulted or threatened by those canards we have been socialized to fear, or by the withdrawal of those approvals that we have been warned to seek for safety. Women see ourselves diminished or softened by the falsely benign accusations of childishness, of non-universality, of changeability, of sensuality. And who asks the question, am I altering your aura, your ideas, your dreams, or am I merely moving you to temporary and reactive action? And even though the latter is no mean task, it is one that must be seen within the context of a need for true alteration of the very foundations of our lives. The white fathers told us, I think, therefore I am. The black mother within each of us, the poet, whispers in our dreams, I feel, therefore I can be free. Poetry coins the language to express and charter this revolutionary demand, the implementation of that freedom. However, experience has taught us that action in the now is also necessary always. Our children cannot dream unless they live. They cannot live unless they are nourished. And who else will feed them the real food without which their dreams will be no different from ours? If you want us to change the world someday, we at least have to live long enough to grow up, shouts the child. Sometimes we drug ourselves with dreams of new ideas. The head will save us. The brain alone will set us free. But there are no new ideas still waiting in the wings to save us as women, as human. There are only old and forgotten ones. New combinations, extrapolations, and recognitions from within ourselves, along with the renewed courage to try them out. And we must constantly encourage ourselves and each other to attempt the heretical actions that our dreams imply, and so many of our old ideas disparage. In the forefront of our move toward change, there is only poetry to hint at possibility made real. Our poems formulate the implications of ourselves, what we feel within and dare make real or bring action into accordance with, our fears, our hopes, our most cherished terrors. For within living structures defined by profit, by linear power, by institutional dehumanization, our feelings were not meant to survive. Kept around as unavoidable adjuncts or pleasant pastimes, feelings were expected to kneel to thought as women were expected to kneel to men. But women have survived, as poets, and there are no new pains. We have felt them all already. We have hidden that fact in the same place where we have hidden our power. They surface in our dreams, and it is our dreams that point the way to freedom. Those dreams are made realizable through our poems that give us the strength and courage to see, to feel, to speak, and to dare. If what we need to dream to move our spirits most deeply and directly toward and through promise is discounted as a luxury, then we give up the core, the fountain of our power, our womanness. We give up the future of our worlds. For there are no new ideas. There are only new ways of making them felt, of examining what those ideas feel like being lived on Sunday morning at 7 a.m., after brunch, during wild love, making war, giving birth, mourning our dead, while we suffer the old longings, battle the old warnings and fears of being silent and impotent and alone, while we taste new possibilities and strengths.
Thanks again for listening. You can find more of Renee's work on her blog, reneejg.net, or purchase her book, The Brief Complete Herstory, at dragoncloudpress.com.